His legacy of resistance will remain for good, and we will continue his path.
General Qasem Soleimani was an international personality and made great achievements in the region. Therefore, not only the Iranian people, but also the people of Iraq, Lebanon, and other countries in the region honor him. He was truly a role model for those who want to fight terrorism and resist arrogant powers.
Iranians believe although the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani put an end to his life, his legacy will continue forever, and he will remain as a role model for all resistance and anti-terror movements.
General Qasem Soleimani's personality was outstanding, not only in terms of decimating Daesh in Iraq and Syria, but also in sending out positive vibes and courage to everyone. It was actually a symbol of international resistance who redefined the rules of leadership. Saman Kujrip, Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina tawaffahumu ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المستضعفين
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Surely, as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious, so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Washington issues fresh sanctions against Tehran over allegations that Iran provides Russia with drones to use in Ukraine. An Israeli minister visits a prison to make sure Palestinian inmates don't have, quote, excessive rights. Hamas has slammed the move as an unprecedented criminal act. Also ahead, Russia says its forces are observing the unilateral 36-hour truce ordered by President Putin, blaming Ukrainians for reported shelling. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, the U.S. accuses Iran of providing Russia with drones to be used in the war in Ukraine and has now imposed new sanctions on the manufacturer of the drones. This is while Iran says it did send drones to Russia, but that was before the start of the war and not for the use in the conflict. We discussed the matter further in our news review, so let's take a quick listen to that first.
U.S. has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran, this time targeting suppliers of drones that Washington claims Russia has been using in its war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of the Quds Aviation Industries. The U.S. Treasury Department described the industries as key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. The sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization. That measures freeze any U.S.-based assets of those targeted individuals and ban Americans from dealing with them. Iran has denied allegations that it's provided Russia with drones to be used in the war in Ukraine. Tehran says it did send drones to Russia, but that was before the start of the war in February. Moscow has also denied using Iranian drones in Ukraine. And now joining us for the program is Yusuf Azizi, Iranian affairs expert, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Firaz Al-Najim, human rights activist, joining us from Ottawa. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Ottawa with you, Firaz. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in cold Canada. Your initial thoughts on the story? We've seen so many sanctions. We've seen this drone thing being tossed around. We know that as of a couple years ago, Iran is free to sell arms wherever it sees fit. What do you, and this is an unfolding story. Your thought, where we stand today with this?
Yes. I mean, the U.S. is biased, and they're trying to kind of put some more maximum pressure on Iran, because with this recent plot and so-called Iranian revolution inside Iran, they failed miserably and they weren't successful with their project. So now they're trying to still push some pressure on Iran and try to kind of like defame the situation, manipulate it. I mean, you know, Russia doesn't really need Iran, I mean, to supply them with drones, you know, in this battle with Ukraine. I think Russia has a lot of other allies they can always buy weapons from. And, you know, this if they really cared about international law and they cared about, you know, caring about, like, human rights and things like this, what they claim, they would arrest Trump, because yesterday we heard the news from Iraq is that they issued a arrest warrant for the former president of the U.S. That killed a general in Iraq, Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, with a drone. So we're talking about drones right now, right? So this is by the highest court in Iraq that they have issued a warrant. So the first thing they should have done before they put sanctions on Iran is first, you know, implement the laws in your own land that that were breached by the former president. So, anyways, I mean, this is all just a way to exploit any seditions and problems inside Iran, and they want to blame the problems that they're doing inside Ukraine on Iran. They want, you know, they're sending massive amounts of weapons, and lots of mercenaries are going inside Ukraine to fight against Russia, and they're okay supplying weapons to whoever they want. They're okay with supplying drones to Saudi Arabia, that is one of the worst human rights violators in the world, and they have caused the worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, and they're continuing to sell them weapons, and they're not putting those sanctions on them, and they're not talking about human rights when it has to do with the Yemeni people. So it shows you this is all hypocrisy and double standard. It's all you know, it's about the interest of their control, you know, their colonial project in West Asia. You know, what about Israel? How come they haven't imposed sanctions on Israel for using drones against the people of Gaza that have been blockaded for so many years? You know, where is the equality and where is the real justice?
Thank you, Firaz and Yusuf. Welcome to the program. Now, Yusuf, you have nuclear powers that try to tell Iran it cannot have a peaceful nuclear program. You have powers that make a fortune, $1 trillion a year, selling arms, especially to Iran's adversaries. We've seen them, to Firaz's point, they give weapons to the Saudis that we know are being used to commit war crimes on women and children in Yemen. They give them to the Israelis that we know are being used to commit war crimes in the Gaza Strip and against other Palestinians, if not Lebanese, at some point in time in history, if you very well know. What do they care about Iran's drone program?
That's true. I would add that, you know, this kind of sanction against Iran military personnel or organization doesn't have any real impact on the current status of Iran-U.S. relation or Iran economic situation, because the maximum pressure campaign that President Trump issued on Iran is still continued by the Biden administration. So nothing can do more about Iran's economic isolation by the West. And this kind of sanction against Iranian military personnel or organization is, you know, just make us laugh, because nobody's in Iran, in the military, in the IRGC, they don't have any kind of assets outside of Iran that Western countries could, you know, get all of those or, you know, freeze those. So what's happening is that the Biden administration doing and continue the maximum pressure, not just on economic issues, but it is a hybrid war against Iran. It is a propaganda against Iran. So it is a full range of using all of the American tools in international affairs. It is covert action. It is military action. It is diplomacy, everything against Iran to come to the negotiation with the limits and terms that United States accept, not Iran. which I'm talking about, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. So the last point is that, you know, the United States sanction against Iran is not working, as it has not been working since the revolution, the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. And we can see that Iran has more power in nuclear industry, in military industry, in regional issues, missiles, drone, everything. So what's happening and what can United States change Iranian behavior? It's just going to revive the original JCPOA. Just imagine if Biden administration, in the first month he came to the White House, he revived, he pushed, he encouraged, he do lots of his in his power to revive the JCPOA. I'm sure that if the JCPOA revived before the war erupted in the Eastern Europe, and nowadays the whole situation in international politics would be different. Iranian oil would be go to the free market, especially in Europe. The energy crisis that the Western countries, especially the European countries, is now facing would be limited. And also the kind of cooperation between Iran and Russia wouldn't be happen. So all of the blames will go for Biden administration, who claimed before he came to the power that he changed the policy of Trump against Iran, but actually he continues that.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in the program. Mr. Yusuf Azizi joining us from Washington, D.C., and Firas Al-Najim there joining us from Ottawa, Canada. And that brings us to the end of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Now, Iran has hosted a conference on slain Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. He was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq in 2020. Yusuf Jalali reports.
3 years have passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani. This is one of the dozens of commemoration ceremonies that have been held across Iran. Senior military and state officials attended a gathering in Tehran to pay their respect to General Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani was the forerunner of all the martyrs who lost their lives in the fight against terrorism. That's why his name continues to be remembered by Iranians.
Not only did the American authorities commit this crime, but they openly took responsibility for it. We have been following up on our legal pursuit with the cooperation of Iraq's judiciary to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Soleimani was the commander of a branch of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps called the Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was killed on January 3, 2020, in a drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Millions took part in his funeral, both in Iraq and Iran. Now, on his third assassination anniversary, Iranians still feel the loss.
It's been 3 years now that we lost our commander. We call him the Commander of Hearts because he fought Daesh overseas to keep the terrorists at bay and prevent them from entering our soil. We owe our security to General Soleimani.
General Soleimani is known for his role in eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
People here say General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. They say the U.S. killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that corroborates Trump's claim that America created Daesh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turning elsewhere now, Israel's new cabinet is already stepping up pressure against Palestinians, including those it holds in prison. Tel Aviv is angry over the Palestinians' appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime says it will impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction and place financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. Israel says the measures are a response to the PA's decision to wage political and legal war against Israel. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has reacted to the Israeli announcement, saying the measures won't block the nation's efforts to end Israeli occupation. Meanwhile, an Israeli minister has paid a visit to an Israeli prison, saying he aims to ensure Palestinians' prisoners' conditions will not improve. Hamas has slammed the visit, calling the plans against Palestinian detainees an unprecedented criminal act.
The visit by the minister of the fascist Israeli regime, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to Nafha prison with the aim of harassing the prisoners is an unprecedented criminal act against them.
Hamas stressed that what the Israeli regime is planning is a dangerous escalation. It said the Palestinian people will not stand idly by while the Israeli forces enforce such schemes. The newly formed Israeli cabinet is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and involves members of extremist Israeli parties. This cabinet is widely viewed as the most far right in the regime's history. The new measures come after months of Israeli violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank that's been unprecedented in nearly 20 years. Regime forces killed more than 220 Palestinians in 2022. Now, tens of thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets of the Yemeni capital Sana'a to demand an end to the Saudi-led coalition's 8-year siege on the country. Protesters called for decisive military action by Yemen against Saudi Arabia and the UAE in order to force them to end their blockade on the country. Yusuf Mowry has more.
A mass rally has been staged in the Yemeni capital along with several other Yemeni provinces called Al-Hisar Harb Alayna, which translates to "The siege is war upon us." Yemen is experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in history, due to what protesters call the U.S. and Saudi Arabia strangling blockade on innocent civilians. Demonstrators called for an immediate end to the blockade and the ongoing war.
We came out in this blessed protest to tell the aggressors and their allies that their blockade is a war on us. Therefore, we, the Yemeni people, say if you do not lift your blockade, we will certainly teach you a lesson you will never forget. We will not sit back and watch our people starve to death.
We came out to deliver a message to the world that we will no longer remain silent on this aggression, war, and blockade on our people.
Yemen's military spokesperson reiterated this week that if the Saudi-led coalition fails to lift the blockade, the Yemeni army will have no choice but to use military force to break the siege. Protesters in Sana'a expressed that it's time to use the military card, since the Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea.
We came out today to tell our military forces to go ahead and strike the capital cities of our enemies so they can be forced to leave the blockade by the will of Allah. Only then they will live in disgrace and humility.
The protest comes after a week of violence stemming from the continuous Saudi shelling in the northern province of Sada, which has killed and injured dozens of civilians over the past 2 weeks. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia continues to seize and detain Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea, preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah and unloading the much-needed fuel supply.
The Saudi-led coalition attacked Yemen in 2015, declaring they would defeat the Ansar Allah movement and their allies within a matter of weeks. It is now 2023, and they have not achieved any of their goals. This, as the Yemeni government based in Sana'a continues to advance its military deterrence capabilities. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
Moving on, Russia and Ukraine blame each other for continued attacks on eastern Ukrainian cities amid a unilateral ceasefire announced by Moscow. Ukrainian officials say Russian forces struck the cities of Kramatorsk to the east and Kherson to the south of the country. Moscow, however, says Russian troops have been fully respecting the ceasefire and accused Ukraine's forces of continued shelling. The 36-hour ceasefire, which began on Friday, was called by President Vladimir Putin with the stated goal of stopping the fighting during the Orthodox Christmas period. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has rejected the truce, describing it as a ploy by Russia to bolster its defenses. The U.S. president was also dismissive. Russia has accused Washington of showing no drive to find a political solution to the Ukraine war. Moscow has repeatedly said it's open to negotiations to end the conflict with Ukraine, rather says Russia must withdraw its forces first. That brings an end to our World Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the Limelight.
In the U.S., on the first day of the new Congress, Representative Kevin McCarthy fell short repeatedly in his bid to become Speaker, as a right-wing rebellion prompted a historic floor fight. Kevin McCarthy faces a small but determined contingent of hardline conservatives who are intent on denying him the votes to secure the gavel. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story and tells us more. Representative Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, failed three times to secure a majority of votes to succeed Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of San Francisco, as Speaker of the House on Tuesday, 3rd of January 2023, before the chamber adjourned with the outcome of the leadership contest still in doubt. The motion to adjourn was adopted with little opposition on Tuesday afternoon, 3rd of January, following hours of roll call votes that failed to elect a speaker. Kevin McCarthy became the first majority party leader in a century to fail to secure the speakership on the first ballot. He attracted zero additional votes on his second ballot and lost support on the third ballot, as Representative Byron Donalds, Republican of Florida, switched his vote from McCarthy to Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio. "The reality is that Kevin McCarthy doesn't have the votes," Donalds tweeted after the vote concluded. "I committed my support to him publicly and for two votes on the House floor. 218 is the number, and currently no one is there. Our conference needs to recess and huddle and find someone or work out the next steps." Republicans appeared to take Donalds' advice as the chamber moved to adjourn until Wednesday afternoon. Kevin McCarthy, however, huddled in the Speaker's office, where reporters spotted pizzas being delivered, signaling that it will be a long night for the GOP leader. House Republicans plan to meet in private on Wednesday morning ahead of a fourth round of voting. The repeated failure to elect a speaker is a clear sign of the divisions within the Republican Party. It is also a potential blow to California. If McCarthy prevails, Congress will hand off power and influence from a California Democrat to a California Republican. If he doesn't, both leaders could be relegated to the backbenchers, one by choice, the other by force. 19 Republicans voted for candidates other than Kevin McCarthy on the first and second ballots. 20 Republicans voted for Jim Jordan on the third ballot, leaving McCarthy 16 short of the 218 votes needed to secure the post he has long sought. Although Tuesday's first round outcome wasn't a surprise, the fact that McCarthy and his allies were not only unable to move votes his way, but also lost ground in subsequent ballots was shocking and potentially fatal to his diminishing path to the speakership. A small number of conservative Republicans had for weeks vowed to oppose McCarthy on the floor when the new Congress convened, even as he continued to negotiate with members and make concessions on rule changes. The figure ballooned to 20 by the third roll call. How the weeks-long stalemate between the majority of the House Republican Conference and a growing pocket of conservative antagonists will be resolved remains unclear after three rounds of voting. The House Speaker election hasn't required multiple ballots on a floor vote since 1923, when Representative Frederick Gillett, Republican of Massachusetts, was elected on the ninth ballot. According to the House historian, every Speaker election that went more than three rounds lasted at least nine rounds, with one going to 133 ballots in the mid-1800s. NBC News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A band of ultra-conservative rebels on Tuesday, 3rd of January, blocked House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy from securing the Speaker's gavel in the first three votes of the new Republican majority, marking the first time the House has gone to multiple ballots to elect a Speaker in 100 years. In a series of dramatic televised votes on the House floor, Kevin McCarthy of California received support from an overwhelming majority of his GOP conference, but that was short of the 218 votes needed to win a simple majority of the 434 House members present. A group of 19 ultra-conservatives opposed him in the first two rounds of voting, but by the third round, that number had grown to 20. The House adjourned for the day just before 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and will return at noon on Wednesday. It's unclear where the Republicans will go from here. Neither McCarthy allies nor his hard-right enemies are backing down. House rules require lawmakers to keep holding votes for Speaker until someone secures 218 votes or a simple majority of members voting. No other House business can occur until a Speaker is selected, which means floor votes, committee hearings and other congressional work will grind to a halt if Republicans can't agree on a new leader. The last time a Speaker vote went to multiple ballots was back in 1923, when Speaker Frederick Gillett, Republican of Massachusetts, won re-election under ninth ballot. During Tuesday's initial vote, the majority of the Conservatives initially backed one of McCarthy's chief antagonists, former Freedom Caucus Chairman Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona. But on the second two rounds, the entire group coalesced around Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, even as Jordan called on Republicans to unite behind Kevin McCarthy. Meanwhile, Democrats unanimously rallied behind the minority leader, Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, in each vote. As is customary, during the first vote of the new Congress, lawmakers stood and cast their vote for Speaker aloud when their name was called. Hakeem Jeffries ended up with more votes than Kevin McCarthy, 212 votes. The House moved to a second round of voting shortly after 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with Jordan nominating McCarthy as Speaker. He told his fellow Republicans that their differences pale in comparison to those between Republicans and Democrats. "We better come together," Jim Jordan said, adding, "I think Kevin McCarthy is the right guy to lead us. I really do." Still, Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, nominated Jim Jordan for the job. "I'm nominating him and I'm voting for him," Gaetz said. On the third round of voting, which began shortly after 4 p.m., Representative Byron Donalds, Republican of Florida, joined conservatives in voting for Jim Jordan. Asked why he changed his vote after previously backing Kevin McCarthy, Byron Donalds said he both believes Jordan will be a tremendous speaker and that there's a reality Republicans are facing. "Kevin doesn't have the votes. This is not a surprise. We knew that Kevin was short of votes. My concern has been like, look, it's been 2 months. You got to close the deal. You had 2 months," Donald said. "And so at this point now, if you can't close it, we got to find someone who can." Donald supported the move to adjourn, saying the party needs to meet and figure out, frankly, who can get 218 votes, and then we go from there. It's an inauspicious start for House Republicans who recaptured the majority in the November midterm elections, but begin the new Congress bitterly divided and without agreement on who should lead the party. Tuesday's votes cap a week-long standoff between Kevin McCarthy and a small band of far-right members close to former President Donald Trump, who vowed to stick together to deny him the Speaker's gavel. Because the GOP's new 222-212 majority is so thin, McCarthy can only lose 4 votes for the top job. 5 conservatives, the so-called Never Kevins, led by Biggs and Gaetz, said they wouldn't vote for McCarthy under any circumstances and urged him to drop out to allow another candidate to step forward.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Declassified. Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be examining the record of Zionist aggression against Black and African American movements from the 1950s to the present day. I'll be talking to experts on this issue after this special report by Latifa Abu-Chakra on the shameful history of the Zionist movement's attacks on Black leaders and movements.
The active use of the tropes about Black anti-Semitism by Zionist groups in relation to recent controversies has a history. We trace the evolution of the anti-Arab and specifically anti-Black racism of the Zionist movement back to the 1960s and beyond. Attacks on prominent Black celebrities and activists for their anti-Semitism are not new. They have a history. In fact, there have been attacks led by Zionist groups against practically all Black leaders or prominent figures of note, from Marcus Garvey in the 1930s to today. His alleged antipathy to Jews was denounced, as were a whole host of Black leaders inspired by Garvey through to the 1960s. One organization key to all of these attacks, but by no means the only one, is the Anti-Defamation League, created in 1913. The full panoply of Black reformists and revolutionary leaders were denounced by the ADL as extremists and Jew-baiting. The Caribbean-born psychiatrist Frantz Fanon was denounced because of his alleged hatred of Jews and the imperialist state of Israel. They also denounced Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Eldridge Cleaver, H. Rapp Brown, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, and the singer Miriam Makeba. Right up to the present day, the ADL continues in denunciations of BLM. One key complaint was the Black denunciations of Zionist manipulation of the anti-racist movement as far back as the 1960s were a mask for anti-Semitism. In fact, of course, Zionist penetration of the anti-racist movement has had the effect that some groups have a blind spot on Palestine. The denunciations have been accompanied by direct action. Since the 1930s, at least the Anti-Defamation League has spied on Black critics of racism and have directly collaborated with the FBI and other organs of the state to attack them. In 1993, the San Francisco District Attorney investigated the ADL for collecting confidential information on nearly 10,000 activists and at least 700 organizations. The investigation showed that the ADL had directly surveilled and infiltrated social justice and human rights organizations. And its agents had received stolen police files from a surveillance program deemed illegal. The ADL even spied on anti-apartheid activists in the US and sold its intelligence to BOS, the intelligence agency of the South African apartheid regime, as well as providing information to Mossad. For the ADL, the black-led anti-racist movement is a bigger threat to Jewish interests than the far-right and white supremacists. When Zionists complain about black anti-Semitism, they're really complaining about uppity black people, especially those who are critical of Israel and Zionism.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Jared Ball. Jared is a professor of communication and African studies at Morgan State University in Baltimore. He's also the author of The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power, a second edition of which is due to be published early next year. Jared also hosts the podcast I Mix What I Like, and he's a co-founder of blackpowermedia.org. His decades of journalism, media, writing and political work can be found at imixwhatilike.org. And we spoke to Jared earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you, though. I mean, tell us about Marcus Garvey and what the Anti-Defamation League, often referred to by its abbreviations, ADL, has to say about him.
Well, Garvey was a hero of the Jamaican nation. And in the film, there was a photograph of a monument to him, which is currently exists in Jamaica. But he was attacked by organizations like the ADL, including the ADL, as far back as the 1930s. He died in 1940. He was regarded as being an anti-Semite. And of course, they didn't pay any attention to his role in a kind of pan-Africanist consciousness, the raising of self-respect amongst black people in the US, and the arguments about what should happen in relation to racism. And of course, that is emblematic of the way in which the ADL and indeed other Zionist organizations in the US targeted anyone who stood up for black civil rights or who argued against racism.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, well, we asked Jared what he made of our report on the ADL's activities in the black community.
Well, the ADL's activities are pretty consistent with their class and ideological or political positioning. And as part of representing the interests of the state, so to speak, they align themselves perfectly well with all of the state's suppressive elements.
David, of course, Frantz Fanon, he wrote the seminal Wretched of the Earth and was active in the Algerian liberation movement, wasn't he? I mean, what was the ADL's gripe with him?
Well, it's one of the first instances, really, of the attempt to blur together anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So they called him an anti-Semite, but what they were really condemning, and they say this explicitly, was his opposition to the imperialist state of Israel. It's a quote from one of their documents. So, you know, I mean, Fanon was, involved with the FLN and the decolonization of Algeria. The Israelis, of course, as we know from previous shows, were involved on the other side and working with the settlers and with their death squads to target the liberation movement. So there's a very clear sense again here that this is about challenges to Israeli foreign policy interests, which of course is what the ADL was involved in from a very, very early age, you know, to actually pursue the foreign policy interests of the state of Israel, as opposed to pursuing what they were supposed to be pursuing, which is alleged anti-Semitism.
Well, we also asked Jared what the reaction to Malcolm X was from the white society in general, and specifically from the Zionist lobby.
White America was and remains, I would argue, terrified of the actual Malcolm that existed, and which is why so much effort is ongoing to posthumously even rebrand him as somebody he wasn't, because his politics and his capabilities remain terrifying to those in power. So, again, the ADL and the Zionist efforts themselves part of a white supremacist, settler, colonialist, capitalist international apparatus targeted Malcolm just as the rest of that apparatus would, which was to, again, falsely define him, misinterpret him, rebrand and represent him in a way that stood against his actual politics and efforts, which of course involved all manner of what I and many others would consider greatness of socialism, pan-Africanism, anti-colonialism, among them.
David, there's a long list of black activists who've been spied on by the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, I wonder, are there any black groups that they didn't spy on?
Well, you, as you say, a very, very long list. I mean, practically everyone who you've ever heard of who has been a leader of a black anti-racist organisation in the US has been spied upon.
Astonishing.
But the key question here is whether they thought that these organisations could be penetrated and mobilised towards their interests. Mm. So, for example, with Dr. King's organisation, Martin Luther King's organisation, they tried to work with that organisation. They tried to penetrate that organisation and make sure it wouldn't be critical of Israel. They had some success with Dr. King.
Indeed.
In some respects on that. But they were still his organisation, the Southern Christian Leadership Organisation, was spied upon by the ADL, as was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was very close to Dr. King back in the early 60s, moved away from it and especially split from it over the question of Palestine. So they wanted to penetrate those organisations, which they could do, to make sure they had a blind spot in Palestine. But they couldn't do that, they were denounced as anti-Semitic.
Jared then told us about the stance of Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam to the ADL.
Well, here I would think there's a little bit of a difference because the politics of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam differ greatly, particularly on some of the isms I just mentioned. Whereas the Nation of Islam, even elements of the Garvey movement aspired to some sort of level of black capitalism, which is decidedly apart and more centrist than the politics of Malcolm and many others to his left. They were still seen as threats to the establishment simply on the basis of their condemnation of the white supremacist nature of the state, of the treatment of black people, of the suppression of Islam and variations of black nationalism, which are and remain important to black liberation. But there is a difference and a nuance here in terms of how the ADL and other elements of the state look to suppress various elements, on the other hand, of the black community and its liberation movement.
Well, thanks for that. Let's just pause there for a moment. This report about how the Anti-Defamation League has been spying on black activists in recent times.
From spying on Desmond Tutu for the South African apartheid regime to smearing Mark Lamont Hill and Ilhan Omar, the Anti-Defamation League sure does get around. In fact, it was found that the cagey organization had spied on at least 10,000 activists in 700 organizations across 7 U.S. cities. At the same time it was spying on Desmond Tutu and selling the information to the apartheid regime, Israeli political figure Shimon Peres was attempting to arm minority white rule in South Africa with nuclear weapons. In 1968, the FBI began officially collaborating with the ADL, with the director of the government agency informing all branches to directly liaise with their regional leaders of the lobby group. This was, of course, simultaneous to the FBI's war against the black community known as COINTELPRO. Was the ADL involved in this shabby conspiracy too? This level of cooperation between the FBI and the ADL did not stop an internal memo by the agency in 1969 from questioning if the ADL worked for Israel. The now declassified document reads, "It is felt incredible to assume the information is not furnished to an official of the government of Israel. It is believed it very possibly represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Despite that, today the ADL is the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the US and is closer to the FBI than ever." Which brings us to the question of a key asset in the black community, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has admitted spying on others for the FBI in the 1980s, describing his role as cooperating with an investigation by using electronic recording equipment in a briefcase to secretly record conversations with targets of interest. He is perhaps the ADL's strongest advocate in the African-American community, regularly appearing alongside ADL leader Jonathan Greenblatt to support his statements. Less known about Al Sharpton is that for many years his show on MSNBC has been produced by Moshe Arenstein, a former intelligence officer in the Israeli military. The black community in the United States is being targeted.
David, that's a really huge number of individuals and groups being spied on, isn't it? I mean, and all this was done with the connivance of the FBI.
The connivance of the FBI going back way back into the century, into the 1940s. There was an involvement there from the 1940s. The ADL tried itself to, first of all, to infiltrate the FBI, and that was rebuffed back in the 40s. But then they started to work very closely with them. And all the way through this period, they've worked closely with them. In the 60s, the files now show, there was some kind of questioning about what that, and we saw in the previous film, the whole question about the relationship with Israel, and the FBI said, well, of course, these people are giving this stuff to Mossad, but this is a bit dodgy, and it probably is against the law, but nevertheless, they continue to collaborate with them. It was only in the 1990s that the investigations first happened in San Francisco of some of the activities where these stats came out, the thousands of people, the hundreds of organizations which were spied upon. What's interesting about this is the way in which that relationship continues to this day. They advertise that they work together. And really what we should be seeing is a move away from the FBI and law enforcement working with the ADL, and more the ADL being monitored by the FBI, because they're clearly working on behalf of a hostile foreign government. And there seems to be no recognition of that in law enforcement circles in the US, but there is in civil society.
Mm. Well, Jared then explained how the ADL's influential position at both YouTube and PayPal in vetting content and access to these services actually affects those platforms.
Well, I don't think the ADL has, from my vantage point at least, I don't think the ADL has any more of an undue negative influence than the platforms already in their commercial organization have from the outset. What the ADL does is play its role within that broader apparatus of pro-imperialist, pro-Zionist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist workings, to limit discussion and narrow discussion to what is considered sanctionable or acceptable to those politics. So they fit right in is sort of the point that I'm getting at. Without the ADL's involvement, there would still be plenty of white supremacist and pro-capitalist and imperialist narrowing of discussion, whether it's through the advertising arrangement, whether it's through outright surveillance and suppression of radical politics, or the like. So here the ADL exists really to play the role among a certain class and ideology of Jews initially and Zionists more broadly to limit the discussion where even among the Jewish community to make sure that radicalism doesn't go too far or get too much of a platform even among Jews. So that is clearly their tactic historically and have used the anti-Semitic trope and the fear of the rise of a new black anti-Semitism for decades now to target, in this case, all forms of the black left to make sure that whether it's on Twitter or historically in newspapers or magazines or elsewhere, that those politics remain equally narrow.
David, the ADL published a hair-raising paper back in 1992 entitled The Anti-Semitism of Black Demagogues and Extremists. I mean, who did they single out in that report?
Well, they didn't single out in the sense of a small number of people. They had a huge list of black politicians and indeed black cultural figures. So amongst the black cultural figures was Ice Cube, the rapper from N.W.A., also, of course, the rap group Public Enemy were singled out in this. You can see it on the screen there. The notion of a black demagogue, extraordinary, really that they could have got away with that. This is a file which is publicly available and has been disclosed through FBI. Freedom of Information documentation. So there's a real sense there which there, any of the key black cultural figures or black political figures were being targeted by the ADL in a way which is really quite, from this distance, clearly racist. But what's interesting about this document is that they say in there that they target extremists. And, of course, if there are Jewish extremists, we will target them as well. But this whole document comes about as a result of the famous Crown Heights riot, which happened as a result of a Chabad rabbi jumping a red light and smashing into two young black kids, one of whom died, and that set off the riots.
Yeah.
And there's no sense in any of this that Chabad, which as we know from previous programs, mm-hmm. is itself an extremist organization. And there's been never been an occasion when the ADL has ever denounced extremist Jewish organizations. And that's partly because it is itself an extremist organization.
Mm. Well, Jared also responded to the claims about the ADL being useful to the FBI as part of its clandestine counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO, much of which was actually illegal. Jared described some of the background to this mysterious program and explained how the ADL could have been useful to it.
Illegal once upon a time, but post 9/11 in the United States, most of everything that was done under the counterintelligence program is now perfectly legal. Making the whole discussion of legality almost moot. But the reality is, again, as I've been just trying to say, the ADL is designed in its own origin in politics and focused as, again, a Zionist, imperialist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist, settler colonial organization. It fits right in with what the politics and the goals of the broader state itself. And certainly the FBI has no problem in promoting those politics and ideas, whether among Jews, Arabs, Black Americans, Christians, whomever else. And that's exactly what they've done and will continue to do. So if the ADL presents itself as being willing to be used, in effect, to take advantage of the actual suffering of Jews historically and in real time, to become part of a very conservative and anti-human apparatus, well, then they'll be put to that use. And to that extent, that's exactly what the ADL has and continues to do, and why they will more than likely continue to find a happy home in allegiance with the FBI and other, again, members of that apparatus, more broadly speaking.
David, tell us about Al Sharpton, who was mentioned in the film there. He's a favoured voice, isn't he, of the ADL?
Yes, but he hasn't always been. And in this document we were just talking about a minute ago, he was one of the key people who was targeted by the ADL as being a black demagogue, an anti-Semite, who'd led what they called a pogrom against the Jews in Crown Heights and the Crown Heights riots. And, of course, now he's not. Now, so what happened? Well, what happened was that his organisation was penetrated. And we saw in the film there the relationship with his producer, who's former Israeli intelligence. But really what we're seeing is part of a more general process whereby Zionist organisations try to penetrate anti-racist organisations to bring them on side so they won't criticise Israel, they won't stand up for Palestinian rights. And if they'll do that, then anything is fine.
Mm. Well, finally, we asked Jared what he made of Sharpton's TV show actually being produced by a former agent of Israeli intelligence.
On some level, I think it matters for sure, and I think it's something that is not to be ignored or set aside. But I think it's on some level even unnecessary to make note of, given the politics of Sharpton and his show. And Sharpton has made clear for a long time that he has been part of the rebranding of black radicalism, excuse me, as something that is supportive of black capitalism, liberal to conservative politics, et cetera. In other words, the rebranding of the actual revolutionary politics of a real life Dr. King as something that would be acceptable to mainstream American news and media, which is, to me, all the evidence we would need of the kind of politics that he is there to represent and has been there to represent. The added fact or note that you mentioned about his producer is, again, interesting and I think adds important context, perhaps, but ultimately isn't that important given the observable, demonstrable, performative politics that Sharpton has been and continues to represent.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. I hope you've found the program informative. Thanks to our guests, Professor Jared Ball, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, This is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Limelight. Majority of U.S. Republicans are against the candidacy of former President Donald Trump in the presidential elections in 2024. Donald Trump is the only president in the history of the United States who has been impeached twice on charges of abuse of power, obstruction of law, and inciting supporters to attack Congress on 6th of January 2021. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered the story and tells us more. Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas says former U.S. President Donald Trump should never be allowed to run for public office again over inciting the deadly violence on 6th of January 2021. Asa Hutchinson, who is considered running for president, reiterated on Sunday, 1st of January, that he preferred a different GOP presidential candidate in 2024, who was not Donald Trump. Hutchinson, a 72-year-old, leaves office in January after serving 8 years as Arkansas's governor. Asa Hutchinson said, "I do not believe that Donald Trump should be the next president of the United States. I think he's had his opportunity there. I think 6th of January really disqualified him for the future." The Arkansas governor said he'd do everything in his power to make sure that there is an alternative Republican